What's the State of the Law and Medical Ethics? Annette Prince may have some answers in this edition of the Bioethics Channel. The Bioethics Channel is a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. practicalbioethics.org. Annette Prince is a clinical assistant professor and director of the Oklahoma Palliative Care Resource Center at the University of Oklahoma. She's in Kansas City to discuss the law and medical ethics during a certificate program sponsored by the Center for Practical Bioethics. Annette, the law and medical ethics intersect at a number of levels. If there was one thing that you would try to get across today, or that you did try to get across today, what was it?
Well, as an attorney, I probably come from a biased perspective, generally in favor of legal intervention and the due process of law in our society. But one of the things we discussed today was there are some instances where I think ethicists, whether students or professional ethicists, certainly healthcare professionals, might be wary of legal intervention. One of the positive interactions historically between the law and ethics was, of course, the doctrine of informed consent, which was pressed upon the health profession by attorneys and by the courts, and is still, to some extent, still resented in some ways by physicians. But I think as we move forward over the past 50 years since that particular intervention by the legal system, now we're looking at laws that might intervene to speak to other issues like feudal care, for example. Some of the states particularly are moving toward enacting legislation that would speak to who will decide when life-sustaining treatment should continue, or when it's appropriate to discontinue or withdraw life-sustaining treatment because it will not result in the desired effect that the patient or the family may be wishing for. About 10 years ago, the state of Texas enacted a law that provided that in a dispute between patients or family or health professionals as to whether life-sustaining treatments such as ventilators or dialysis or hydration nutrition should be continued, Texas decided to give that responsibility to ethics committees in the hospitals, for example. That's been in effect for about 10 years. There have been some appeals to the court.
It's been somewhat controversial.
Yes,
has it
has been controversial from the beginning. And one of the arguments in favor of making this change, and this was the first state to do this, was that physicians were hard pressed to assert what they felt was the ethical treatment of patients, particularly if they felt that patients might be harmed by continued aggressive treatment because they feared litigation. And so what the Texas legislature did was provide immunity to the physician, the hospital, and even the members of the ethics committee if they determined that treatment was in fact futile and should be discontinued. And that gave the family a time to transfer the patient if they could find another facility. But if they couldn't, then the treatment was terminated.
Our friend Bill Colby, the attorney for the Nancy Kurzan family, has said more than once that the black and white of the law is sometimes not all that healthy, or not all that helpful in some of the murky situations where right and wrong are not that black and white. Do you agree with him?
I do, definitely. I believe in the law. I think if I had to compare the legal system to the healthcare system right now, I'd say the legal system is probably in better health than the healthcare system in terms of the processes working in terms of giving people a fair hearing and due process and the right to review. But the law can be a very blunt instrument. And in this case, last year Virginia chose to follow Texas. So that now we have two states that are using the law rather than ethical analysis to make medical decisions. So I think the law can be very blunt. The courts themselves, since the early 70s in the Karen Ann Quinlan case, started saying these sorts of medical issues, particularly life and death decisions, shouldn't be coming to the courts. They should be reviewed by some sort of process that includes physicians, nurses, people who have the expertise. We really don't want to hear these cases. But again and again, in the Cruzan case, as you mentioned, in the Terry Schiavo case, they still do, unfortunately, wind up in the courts at times.
You touched on the issue of informed consent, and we talked briefly before the program about how that concept has become more challenging in recent years because of the rapid advance of medicine. There are more choices, and then that bumps a little bit into the concept of patient autonomy. And it's hard to find the balance there, isn't it?
It is, and I think, as in so many other situations in society, instead of finding a balance, too many times we go from one extreme to the other. And certainly 50 years ago, paternalism, the physician knows best, was the only way to go. And when you think about it, people don't go to medical school to learn to communicate, to learn to facilitate discussion with groups.
Really?
They really don't. I think these young people go to medical school to learn how to save lives, certainly to learn how to keep people alive. And the medicalization of illness has given us so many options in terms of treatment. Maybe not necessarily cure, but treatments that will keep us alive, despite, you know, what the quality of that life might be. A physician that is presenting these alternative treatments to the lay public, the family members, the patient who doesn't have the medical education, it can be overwhelming to a patient or a family member. And I think too many times, because of the lack of education in regard to palliative care particularly, the physician forgets to present the option of doing nothing or providing comfort care as opposed to the more aggressive cares. So I think we've swung from the paternalism 50 years ago to this incredible autonomy situation where when I talk to residents, they're afraid to say, you know, there is another chemotherapy trial, maybe the fourth or the fifth trial that you can elect to take, and this would be the benefit of that, possibly. You would have a 7% chance or whatever. That physician is afraid to say, but I wouldn't choose that, you know, or if it were my mother, I would consider pain management and comfort care and the quality of the life as opposed to the 7% chance, because the physician is so impressed with the idea of autonomy at this point in history that they feel their job is to present a cafeteria plan and it's the patient's job to make the decision. And I think what we should be striving for is a shared decision-making process in terms of informed consent. Signing a form is not informed consent. It may be a consent to something, but the idea that so many of us are going to be enduring chronic illness as opposed to acute illness, we really need to view informed consent as a continuing process rather than a discrete legal event.
How did the group respond today to all of this? Any surprises to you?
Well, I think that the students are very much aware of the challenges that are facing them in pursuing education in bioethics. There are so many issues that are open now. I think 50 years ago, when we said, when Judge Cardoza said, you cannot touch a patient without their consent or you will be guilty of battery, it seemed like that was the answer. That was the end of the story. But now it seems like every issue is so complex that the individual who is looking forward to a career in bioethics needs to have a lot of information about the law, for example. I know in talking to medical students and residents, you know, they have an undergraduate degree, they have a medical degree, and I come in and say, you need to know the law about advanced planning, about hydration nutrition. You need to know the law in the state, maybe in the county, that will govern your practice, because whether we like it or not, generally speaking, the law trumps ethics. And I think more and more we're going to see issues where physicians are going to feel very strongly that something that they're being asked to do is not ethical, but it may be the law.
That leads into my final question then. Where do you see this being in 5 years, 10 years, this balance, maybe not perhaps a conflict, but at least trying to seek that balance between the law and medical ethics?
I hope that the profession of bioethics and the education that we're seeing that's being offered more readily to people around the country will encourage health professionals to gain that knowledge and take on the challenges so that the law doesn't have to step in and perhaps provide us with answers that in the long run, they may be easy in the short run, but we may not be happy with them.
Annette Prince is a clinical assistant professor and director of the Oklahoma Palliative Care Resource Center at the University of Oklahoma. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.